just finished The Lens of Time. It's like the Infinity Stones now. And we're on lens number 40.
The Lens of Soul?
The Lens of Soul. The Lens of Space.
The Lens of Power?
Lens 40, The Lens of Reward. Oh, wait. Did we do this one already? I think we did Lens of Reward already. So. Yeah. Alright. Balance type number 9. Punishment. With the Lens of Punishment. Lens 41. Punishment must be used delicately, since after all, players in the game of their own free will. Balanced appropriately will give everything in your game more meaning, and players will have a real sense of pride when they succeed in your game. To examine the punishments in your game, ask yourself these questions. What are the punishments in my game? Why am I punishing the players, and what do I hope to achieve by it? Do my punishments seem fair to the players? Why or why not? Is there a way to turn these punishments into rewards and get the same or better effect? Are my strong punishments balanced against commensurately strong rewards?
So I'm trying to think of examples of games that use punishment a lot, and I can't come up with any really strong ones. Most of what I'm thinking is the original ways in Kerbal Space Program for enforcing antennas. Basically, if you didn't have an antenna and you didn't do all the busy work about having your antenna pointed in the right place, you just couldn't play the game. It was just broken.
Was it?
I mean, so this is referring to Remote Tech.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. If you were using Remote Tech,
yeah.
Originally, you had to do all of this busy work. You had to get everything installed in all the right places. You had to set up a whole communications network. Because the only place on Kerbin that you could actually phone home to was the Kerbal Space Center.
Right.
So you had to have a whole constellation around Kerbin, and then you had to set up your spaceship to phone home to that constellation, but you had to pick an individual satellite every time. And you had to...
Wow.
I don't know if you could do that if you didn't have comms. Like, if you let your spaceship fall out of comms range, could you change it? Maybe. I don't know.
Right. It's just lost forever.
Yeah. And so it felt really punishing because it's like, well, I have all the stuff that I have to do, and if I don't do it, then I just can't play the game.
Sure.
And,
Well, I feel like games do punishment a lot in smaller ways, like, not allowing you to save at certain spots, or, not allowing, you know, like preventing progress, until you've done this or that kind of thing. Story rewards, right? You give a story reward, and then you, if you do something that the game designer doesn't think that you should, then you get a story punishment and the story ends, right? Like, oh, it's a bad ending. Or death cutscenes, or things like that. Reloading the whole level from scratch. I mean, some of this gets into technology and stuff, but it really seems like it shouldn't be that hard, where you die in a level and then has to reload the whole level. Why can't you just reset the things that changed? I don't know.
So I do think a lot of those examples get into technology, and I've never really thought of any of them as punishments, except maybe for kill screens or death screens. Because save points were really a result of a medium that didn't have a way to interface with it. You had 8 buttons, and 4 of them were specifically directions. And so how are you supposed to get the player to tell you, I want to save the game right now? Well, I guess you could, like, create some song and dance they could do. Or you could just put something in the world every now and then, and whenever they get to it, they can save the game. And so that was a solution to a problem, which is that the game doesn't have a good interface, more than it was a punishment. Now,
well,
maybe they didn't put them together as frequently as they should have, but I don't think they did it intending to punish the player.
Well, it's also creating a puzzle space where you've got this long chain of puzzles, and each puzzle is divided by a checkpoint so that you know, okay, I've finished that puzzle. It had to do with a certain thing, hopefully, if your theming is good, right? It had to do with a certain theme or a certain skill you had to exercise, and then you get to the next puzzle and you've got a checkpoint and you go to the next thing. But like in the Mario games, it didn't have that at all. Like there were worlds, I suppose, but then there were lives. Like lives is a punishment system because it prevents you from making too many mistakes. If you make more mistakes than the game thinks you should, then you just have to start over.
That's true. And the lives really felt very arcadey to me. Like, if you were playing Mario on an arcade machine,
oh, sure,
it would ask you for a quarter every time you needed to continue.
Right.
And so I always thought of it as kind of arbitrary and a holdover from some previous system. And it's like, oh, well, I mean, obviously I'm going to click continue. I don't want to play the whole game again, guys.
Yeah.
But it was probably there so that they could put the to click continue, insert one quarter in there in the arcade room.
Right. But arcades are, like, asking for money is a form of punishment, right? To keep playing this game, you have to give this money. To keep playing this game, you've got to push continue.
That's kind of an arbitrarily negative way of thinking about paying for things, but sure.
I don't think it is.
Well, I mean, you're essentially describing fines, right? Like, yeah. You died, so I'm going to fine you one quarter.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Which, maybe that's what arcades are doing, but you can also think of it as for the privilege of using this machine, because this machine costs the arcade owner money to run.
Well, but it only costs money to run because the game company is punishing the arcade guy for having it in his shop.
Well, no, he has to pay for power for it, too, and he has to
pay
for the space.
That's an insignificant cost, and you know it. Well, you know that the cost of the power is completely insignificant, and the cost of the space is basically free.
What about the cost of the minimum wage 17-year-old that's running the place?
I don't know. If he's running the place, he'd better be making some money somehow.
No, he's just standing there stopping kids getting in fights.
Yeah?
He doesn't own the place or anything.
Man, he should start kids getting in fights. He could run a kid fight rink.
He'd make more money that way.
He's bringing in way more money than having Mario on an arcade machine. Lens of punishment. Then you could send your kids to the fight rink as punishment. It's a meta punishment.
For doing a bad job at Mario, I sentence you to one round
to go
of
to the arcade and talk to Stephen.
Oh, Stephen.
Lens 42, the lens of simplicity versus complexity. Striking the right balance between simplicity and complexity is difficult and must be done for the right reasons. If it's not done for the right reasons, we will send you to the punishment zone! No. Use this lens to help your game become one in which meaningful complexity arises out of a simple system in the passive voice. Ask yourself these questions. What elements of inane complexity do I have in my game? Oh, not inane. Innate. Huh. I was reading too much into the text there. Is there a way this innate complexity could be turned into emergent complexity? I suppose you could make it inane complexity as well. Do elements of emergent complexity arise from my game? And if not, why not? Are the elements of my game... Are there elements of my game that are too simple?
So he defines emergent complexity earlier in the page.
Emergent complexity is the kind of complexity that everyone praises. Games like Go have a very simple rule set that give rise to very complex situations and are said to have emergent complexity. When games are praised for being simple and complex at the same time, it is emergent complexity that is being praised. And innate complexity is when the rules of the game are very complex.
Got it. So I feel like this is something that probably is important to the way you want to interface with games, because you really want games that have very simple rule sets, but rule sets that cover a broad enough space that you can explore a lot of possibility within those rules.
Yeah.
And that's not what everybody wants, but it is what you want. And so I feel like this lens is for making games that you want.
Perhaps. Well, I think that everyone would prefer to not have to deal with a whole bunch of complicated rules. People add rules because they find the game to be unchallenging or boring, and so that instead of... it's just easier to add more rules. That's how we got football, right? Like, American football has tons of rules in it because, oh, well, if you get guys lined up, it turns out that the guys who can push the hardest win, and then people get injured, so you've got to get a whole bunch of fancy rules to figure out how to make it more interesting to watch and less boring.
I don't think they've actually dealt with the "and then guys get injured" part of that equation yet.
Well, they've certainly addressed it to some degree.
They put helmets
on them. Yeah, you can't grab face masks and things.
Yeah.
But I think that ideally one would have a very simple rule set, and that no one would object to having a simple rule set, that it gives rise to the same complexity of experience.
Sure. So this kind of recalls Dominion and other games like that, where the rules of the game that are actually written down in the rule book are pretty simple. It's like, draw a card, play a card, that's all.
Right.
But then the rules that result from the deck that you build in Dominion wind up being very complicated. And it probably borders on this innate complexity where he's talking about the rules are so complicated that it's almost punishing to use. And it reminds me of a few Dominion games I've played where we spend about the same amount of time looking up errata and clarifications about how cards interact as we did actually playing the game.
Yeah, it's a game for rules lawyers.
Yeah. Which, I mean, that's fine with me.
But... Right, that's the kind of game you would like. But if, I mean, if the rules were actually very complicated, it would be even worse, right? If there were a whole bunch of complicated rules on top of the rules that you build.
Yeah.
It seems like Dominion has been able to succeed because it has fundamentally a fairly simple model.
Right.
Cool. Yeah, simplicity versus complexity. I like the idea of having complexity arise out of simplicity instead of just making it complex on purpose.
Yeah.
And that's a problem that a lot of Minecraft mods have, is they're like, oh, well, there aren't enough kinds of ore in the game, so we'll just add, like, 50 kinds of ore. Well, that's not really... It doesn't really add to the experience. Like, I already have to find ore. Like, I don't want to have to find 50 different types of ore and then combine them in different alloys. Like, that's not... It's not an interesting experience, right?
Right.
It would be much better to address the deeper gameplay progression issues or whatever. There are a lot of other things to do in Minecraft to improve it than adding types of ore.
Some of the, I'll call them intermediate Kerbal Space Program mods, did a really similar thing where people were... So there was an original resource mod called Keythane. In
yes.
Kerbal Space Program, and you just went out and you mined this magical resource, Keythane, and you could turn it into rocket fuel, and you could turn it into oxygen, and you could turn it into whatever you wanted, and it was great. And then people said, hey, Keythane isn't real, that's... You can't make anything out of something. You have to have lots of things to make anything. And so a bunch of people made resource mods, and in many respects, they were a lot more polished than Keythane was. So they gained a lot of popularity, but they were super complicated, because if you wanted to actually make rocket fuel, you had to go find, like, hydrogen deposit, because hydrogen lives underground, apparently, and an oxygen deposit, right? You had to find all these different things just to make rocket fuel, and then you had to find something to make oxidizer, and if you wanted to make something else, because you had the colonization mod or something, then you had to find something that had ore in it.
Sure.
And so you wound up needing a bunch of different things to do the really simple thing that Keythane did earlier, and if you were trying to build, like, a whole moon colony, then it would probably be fairly rewarding for you. But if you were trying to just be like, hey, can I get a base on the moon that can get itself back into space, it required three times as much work as Keythane did.
Right.
And I feel like the most telling thing about this is that later on in the game's play cycle, someone made a new mod that had all the modern polish that players expected, that was basically just a restatement of Keythane, and he called it something else, but
right.
It was still something where you go out and you mine this one thing and you turn it into whatever you want.
Sure. And then when the game came to doing resources, it did essentially the same thing, where you just get ore, right?
Right.
Yeah. Which was a disappointment in its own way, because there's a 100% mass conversion rate with zero loss between ore and whatever it is that you want to make.
Yes. Rocket fuel is 100% the same thing as ore. You just have to... maybe they've got some space chem.
Oh, man. They're rearranging them on a molecular level.
Yep.
I don't think that's how that works. It does take a lot of power, and it generates a lot of heat. Yeah, man. It's a subatomic thing. They're transmuting elements from one kind to another.
Yep. Maybe it's actually that other Zachtronics game about changing one thing into another thing.
Magnus Opum?
That's the one.
Opus Magnum?
Yes.
I forget which. It's one or the other. It's one of those two.
Opus Magnum. It's a really good game. You should play it.
Yeah!
Not you specifically, because you already have.
I have.
You, the listener.
Have you beat the last level?
I think I have.
Excellent.
I haven't beat the last level of Space Camp, but I have beat the last level of Magnum.
Oh, yeah? Magnum. Yeah, man. I don't know what it is about the last level of Zachtronics games, but they're daunting.
Yeah. I haven't beat the last level of Shenzhen I.O. either.
Nor I. That's where I stopped. I was like, I see the Matrix now, and I'm not gonna go in. Take the blue pill.
Yeah.
Wait, was that right?
I think you took the red pill, but honestly, I don't remember. It's been like a decade since I've seen those movies.
Fuchsia pill.
No, see that's the XKCD thing. You cut open both pills, you mix chop the stuff together, and you snort the purple stuff.
Snort. That's right. And then you have a crazy. What happened at the end of that? It yeah. just like turned inside out.
Yeah, I don't remember specifically. The world changed in an unexpected way.
Right. Lens 43, the lens of elegance. Most classic games are considered to be masterpieces of elegance. Use this lens to make your game as elegant as possible. Ask yourself these questions. What are the elements of my game? What is the purpose of each element? Count these up and give the elements all an elegance rating! Oh, man. You were doing so well.
That doesn't sound very elegant.
For elements with only one or two purposes, can some of these be combined with each other or removed altogether? For elements with several purposes, is it possible to make them take on even more? So it seems like his definition of elegance here is that each element performs every purpose.
So elegance is something that I was talking about with some friends that I play games with about once a week.
Hmm.
And the way they described elegance, or one of them anyway, is that elegance is kind of... I feel like elegance is more on the line of emergent complexity in this case, where elegance is a really simple rule set that gives rise to a lot of possibility. And therefore, the game is really easy to learn because there's only a handful of things to memorize. But it winds up being really complicated to play because you can apply those things in a lot of different ways. And that came up because we have another friend who doesn't like learning new game systems. And in many cases, he'd rather just sit next to people who are learning a new game system and watch them play it because it's just too much work to learn the new system and there's not enough reward for it.
Sure.
And the systems that he does enjoy are typically really elegant systems where there's a high degree of simplicity in terms of the learning involved, but also a really high skill cap where getting good at the game makes a big difference in your success rate.
Right. So what was your conclusion about elegance then? Or was that it?
That's what we decided elegance was. Is a game that can be learned quickly, but has a lot of room for you to master it.
Sure.
There's a long...
Easy to learn and hard to master.
Right.
Cool. Lens 44. The lens of character. Elegance and character are opposites.
What?
They are like miniature versions of simplicity and complexity, and must be kept in balance. To make sure your game has lovable defining quirks, ask yourself these questions. Is there anything strange in my game that players talk about excitedly? Does my game have funny qualities that make it unique? Does my game have flaws that players like?
I feel like if players like them, they're not flaws. So that seems like a weird way to word your question.
Well, his example that he gives earlier is the Leaning Tower of Pisa, which, while it is a flaw that it's leaning, it also gives it character.
But the leaning is a flaw in that the Leaning Tower of Pisa cannot be used as a building.
Right, it's not a game if it can't function as a game.
Right, it changes it from a building to a landmark, because if you used it as a building, it would fall all the way over, and your stuff would get lost.
Yeah.
In the rubble heap. So I'm not sure how to apply that analogy to games.
Yeah. Well, he brings up also Mario is a plumber, even though there's really no in-world reason for him to be a plumber.
does go through all those pipes.
Right, but they could be anything.
That's true. I don't feel like that's a flaw, though.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's just, it's quirk. He brought up quirks earlier.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to agree that Mario as a plumber is a quirk.
Sure. Strange, funny, quirky qualities.
Right. But it's not a flaw. Like, it doesn't somehow make sure. It worse at itself.
Yeah. It seems like this lens could be misused to defend sloppy design.
Yeah.
Where it's like, well, we designed this thing and we didn't put a lot of effort into it, but man, I really like it. I really like how it does this thing. And it's like, well, have you tried fixing it and see if you like it better?
Yeah. Or like games that are meant to draw on like a particular piece of nostalgia or propaganda or something.
Hmm.
And so the game isn't actually very good, but your player base really likes it because it supports this idea that they agree with.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm not a super fan of this one at this point.
Lens of character. All right. Well,
maybe he just did a bad job of defining character, because the quirk thing is fine, yeah. Right? Like, make Mario a plumber. That's a fun quirk, and it has resulted in a lot of humor. But the flaw thing, I feel like maybe he just worded that poorly.
Think of the tokens in Monopoly. A hat, a shoe, a dog, a statue, and a battleship. They have nothing to do with the game about real estate. Arguably, they should be themed as little landlords, but no one would do that because it would strip Monopoly of its character. I don't know if that's true.
I don't know if that's true either. No. I've always thought it was just, like, weird and arbitrary that there are hats and shoes and cars.
Lens 44, the lens of arbitrary nostalgia.
All right.
Okay, lens 45, the lens of imagination. All games have some element of imagination and some element of connection to reality. Use this lens to help find the balance between detail and imagination. Ask yourself these questions. What must the player understand to play my game? Can some element of imagination help them understand it better? What high-quality, realistic details can we provide in this game? What details would be low-quality if we provided them? Can imagination fill the gap instead? Can I give details that the imagination will be able to reuse again and again? What details I provide inspire imagination. What details I provide stifle imagination.
So this brings to mind Kerbal Space Program again, and we talk about Kerbal Space Program a lot on this podcast. But,
it's a shared context.
Yes, but it's also a really good example, I think, of a lot of the fundamental game design principles and toy design principles that this book is talking about. And this is one of them, where Kerbal Space Program is a game where the only rules are pretty close to real physics. So the only rule is what goes up must come back down, and momentum is conserved. Those are the two rules. And
right.
From there you can get orbital mechanics, because those are the only rules of orbital mechanics. And a lot of people in the Kerbal Space Program community complain that Kerbal Space Program isn't realistic enough, because gravity falls off way too fast, and the planets are too small, and your orbital speeds are too low, and a bunch of things like that. But I feel like that's... I don't know if it was deliberate. Maybe it was deliberate. But I feel like that actually serves a broader purpose, because in Kerbal Space Program, if you want to get to the moon and you don't know anything about orbits, you can just build a bigger rocket until you can point your rocket at the moon and get to the moon.
Right.
And you really can't do that in real life, and there are mods for Kerbal Space Program that change the size and the mass of everything so that gravity falls off more like it does in real life, and orbital velocities are more like they are in real life, and you wind up needing to make more real-life choices about, well, we need to choose this type of orbit, and it's going to take us 2 weeks to get to the moon instead of 2 days. And while that's nice and it has its own place, it really kind of hampers the sort of imaginative play that I think the developers were going for, where it's like, I don't know what I'm doing, but I want to go to the moon. And Kerbal Space Program has avenues that reward people who don't know what they're doing and just go to the moon, and people who want to bother figuring out what they're doing and go to one of the more distant planets.
Right.
Because the harder your mission is, the less you can rely on more boosters to make it happen.
Yeah.
I feel like the balance of those two things, where the imaginative play of I want to go to the moon is possible, but the detailed, almost study of how do I get to Joule, which is like Jupiter in the Kerbal Space Program universe, are both possible in the same game. And I feel like that's actually a really important part of what made Kerbal Space Program successful.
It's also stylized enough that you're not tempted to believe that it's realistic. All the characters are very cartoony, and all the parts are simplified and brightly colored, and the world, as you said, is much smaller than it should be, and everything's kind of exaggerated. And so it allows you to imagine, okay, well, this isn't real, but I can imagine what it's simulating.
Right.
Another one that comes to mind is Minecraft, which is not detailed enough to really even tempt you to believe that it's real, but nevertheless inspires a lot of imagination for, well, this is a house I built, and I can imagine what it would feel like to be here, even though it doesn't look like I'm in a real place.
Yeah, I feel like the difference is Minecraft encourages imagination in that you're like, well, what if I built this thing, and then you can go build it. But it doesn't really offer opportunities for exploring the real rules.
Sure.
Where Kerbal Space Program does have that opportunity. You don't have to learn orbital mechanics to play Kerbal Space Program, and certainly not if you just want to go to the moon.
Right.
But if you want to do the more challenging things in Kerbal Space Program, and you're really going to have to at least go brush up against the...
Yeah.
And, you know, read somebody else's tutorial about when to launch and how much fuel you're going to need and things like that.
Lens 46. The lens of economy. Giving a game an economy can give it surprising depth and a life of its own. But like all living things, it can be difficult to control. Use this lens to keep the economy in balance. How can my players earn money? Should there be other ways? What can my players buy? And why? Is money too easy to get or too hard? How can I change this? Are choices about earning and spending meaningful ones? Is a universal currency a good idea in my game, or should there be specialized currencies?
So the master class in game economies remains EVE Online.
Mm.
If you want to know,
run by real economists.
Yeah. If you want to know how to put a compelling economy in your game, go have a look at EVE Online, because it's literally just a compelling economy. That's the whole game. Also, there are spaceships, which are kind of secondary.
Finally, we have Lens 47, the lens of unhelpful advice. I mean balance.
Aha!
There are many types of game balance, and each is important. However, it is easy to get lost in the details and forget the big picture. Use this simple lens to get out of the mire and ask yourself the only important question, does my game feel right? Why or why not? This was more than one question. That's it.
Yeah.
It's the lens of balance.
I feel like that's the game of, am I good at my job? Which is actually a pretty hard question to ask yourself.
Sure.
So maybe this is the game of focus testing, except focus group testing is also terrible. It's the game of play testing. Ask someone else to play your game, and if they think it is balanced, then they're probably wrong. So ask a lot of more people.
Keep asking until you're pretty confident. So next is Chapter 12, Game Mechanics Support Puzzles. And he's got good puzzles, which have an easy-to-understand goal, and easy to get started. And then we get to Lens 48, the lens of accessibility. When you present a puzzle to players, or a game of any kind, they should be able to clearly visualize what their first few steps would be. Ask yourself these questions. How will players know how to begin solving my puzzle, or playing my game? Do I need to explain it, or is it self-evident? Does my puzzle or game act like something that they have seen before? If it does, how can I draw attention to that similarity? And if it does not, how can I make them understand how it does behave? Does my puzzle or game draw people in and make them want to touch it and manipulate it? If not, how can I change it so that it does?
So the first thing this brought to mind was the newspaper ciphers from when we were kids. Maybe they're still in the newspaper, but I haven't got a newspaper in a long time. And back when I was a kid, there were these cipher puzzles at the bottom of the comics page. And I remember looking at them, and I understood that they were a cipher, but they weren't just letter replacement or something like that, and I was 9.
Sure.
And so I just kind of looked at them and I was like, well, I can tell there's a puzzle here, but I can't even begin to start solving it, so moving on.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the opposite of accessibility, where your puzzle is so obtuse that people just move on.
it needed a, an introductory level cipher or something.
Yeah.
To work into the more difficult levels.
And like, because they always had the solutions to last week on them, so maybe if I had last week's paper and this week's paper, I could have figured something out. But I never had last week's paper, because it got recycled in the meantime.
Because you were nine.
Right.
Who would keep newspapers around?
I was not in charge of keeping the newspapers.
And the lens of visible progress. Lens 49. Players need to see that they are making progress when solving a difficult problem. To make sure they're getting this feedback, ask yourself these questions. What does it mean to make progress in my game or puzzle? Is there enough progress in my game? Is there a way I can add more interim steps of progressive success? What progress is visible and what progress is hidden? Can I find a way to reveal what is hidden? Puzzle principles number 4 and 5 are give a sense of solvability and increase difficulty gradually, which, yes, parallelism lets the player rest. The lens of parallelism. Parallelism is your puzzle. In your puzzle brings parallel benefits to the player's experience. To add this lens, ask yourself these. Are there bottlenecks in my design where players are unable to proceed if they cannot solve a particular challenge? And if so, can I add parallel challenges for a player to work on when this challenge stumps them? If parallel challenges are too similar, the parallelism offers little benefit. Are my parallel challenges different enough from each other to give the players the benefit of variety? Can my parallel challenges be connected somehow? Is there a way to make progress in one that can make it easier to solve the others?
So we were talking a little bit about the Final Fantasy games yesterday, and I feel like the Final Fantasy games are kind of an example of bad parallelism, because what we talked about yesterday, which I think was off mic, was my daughter is trying to play Final Fantasy V, and she's just got to the first boss, and the first boss is so much harder than everything that has come before it, that it's really frustrating to her, and she's really not even interested in the game anymore because she can't beat this fight. And the answer that Final Fantasy has for you is, well, go back outside and kill monsters until you are strong enough to fight this boss, which is a parallel challenge because you're exercising the same skills, basically.
Right. It's not different enough.
Right. It's not different enough. And it doesn't do enough for the player, right? Like, your characters are getting better.
Sure.
And so that's why later you can come back and you can beat the boss, but it doesn't really teach the player how to kill stuff.
Yeah,
it doesn't more teach you efficiently.
Anything new.
Right. I mean, the way we played Final Fantasy when we were younger was in an emulator, and when we needed to gain experience, we turned on the speed boost in the emulator so that we could just run around and then hold down the button.
Hold down attack.
Right. So that we could just murder everything. And that's clearly not teaching us anything. That's just solving the busy work.
Right.
And I feel like that's an example of bad parallel, but an example of good parallel did not jump to mind immediately.
This seems very similar to what you're saying about the head and the hands, where you have multiple paths to success and allow players to think their way through or to brute force their way through, whatever they would prefer.
Well, I think this one is more about learning a specific skill set. And so the ideal here would be you set up kind of a long way and a short way. And the short way is hard, but it's hard in the same way that the long way is easy. And so in the long way, you wind up getting a bunch of practice doing whatever it is that you need to accomplish this challenge.
Sure.
And then in the short way, if you've already mastered the skill, you just go do the short way and then you're done. And so the long way is there really kind of as a tutor for the short way. And I think that's more what he's talking about. And I feel like that's pretty valuable. I just can't think of any good examples.
Yeah. It seems like Space Chem, if it had more ability to skip levels, would be kind of like this. But usually it doesn't allow. It's just the long way the whole time, right?
I mean, Space Chem did have bonus levels. Mm-hmm. And so you could kind of think of bonus levels as this parallel reward where you can just keep going through the game. And the bonus levels are a significant step up in terms of complexity.
Sure.
But they do build meaningfully on the skills that you learned in that particular world.
Yeah.
So maybe the bonus levels in Space Chem are, but they're not a bottleneck. So I feel like they fail that first question.
Well, in Magnus Opum or whatever it is, Opus Magnum, the levels come in groups of 2s and 3s, and you don't have to beat them all. You only have to beat 2/3 of them to advance.
Yeah, something like that.
It's some less than 100% completion thing. So then, if you get stuck on a particular puzzle or feel like, oh, well, this is too hard for me, or the way you're thinking about it, mean, I don't know. Right. I always just did them all.
Right. I always did them all, so I don't remember exactly how that worked.
Yeah. But I think the idea was that if you get stumped on a particular one, you can just skip it, and that's fine. Yeah. So that's kind of like parallel paths. It's building a kind of currency or a score that allows you to unlock content in order. But then the question arises, well, why can't you just do the final levels from the beginning? Like, if you already know how to do it, or if you're like, okay, yeah, I get it, then...
Yeah, and I think this is something where you might differ with a lot of people, because I felt like the story in Opus Magnum was actually a fun addition.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree.
I enjoyed interfacing with it in the order that I interfaced it.
Yeah.
In the order in which, anyway.
In the order in which you interfaced with it.
Yeah, that's too many uses of the word in, so with I should revise that entire sentence to avoid saying in
the
twice.
Interface was interfaced by you.
Yeah, but I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm just going to move on.
Okay.
And if the game had the option to just, like, you can play the whole game, or you can just do the final level, and then we'll give you the achievement. A lot of people could have just solved that final level, and maybe we could have. Yeah. I don't know. But I feel like there would have been kind of a loss in the experience of playing the game, and we certainly wouldn't have got the fun of interacting with the story and then getting to participate with it in an admittedly arbitrary way, right? Like all the Zachtronics games, the story is there and the story is fun, but they don't really mesh with gameplay very well.
Well, they certainly don't react to gameplay. I feel like the theme of the gameplay and the theme of the story is always remarkably good. You know, they mesh together nicely.
Yeah.
But how well you do at solving the puzzle doesn't have any effect on how the story turns out.
Right. But I felt like it was a generally positive experience, regardless. And the fact that the story was kind of held behind these puzzles didn't make it worse.
Right. Lens 51, the lens of the pyramid. Pyramids fascinate us because they have a singular highest point. To give your puzzle the allure of the ancient pyramids, ask yourself these questions. Is there a way all the pieces of my puzzle can feed into a singular challenge at the end? Big pyramids are often made of little pyramids. Can I have a hierarchy of ever more challenging puzzle elements, gradually leading to a final challenge? Is the challenge at the top of my pyramid interesting, compelling, and clear? Does it make people want to work in order to get to it?
Maybe this is why the last puzzle in Zachtronics games is always so hard.
It's the pyramid.
Yeah, because I feel puzzle. Like, in a lot of ways, the Zachtronics games build one corner of the pyramid at a time.
Mm.
And so you spend the first world learning all the way up one side of the pyramid, and you spend the second world learning all the way up another side of the pyramid. And then in the last level, it's like, okay, now we're going to put all the sides together, and we're going to actually get to the top of the pyramid.
Mm.
But it's been like 3 weeks since you did the first side of the pyramid, and you're like, man, I don't remember how to do that.
Yeah.
That sounds really complicated.
To go back and review.
Yeah. And so I remember with Space Chem, and to a lesser extent, Shenzhen IO, when I got to the last level, I looked at it and I was like, man, I know how to do this, but it's going to be so complicated just putting everything together. It's going to take me forever and it's going to be really frustrating. So just, like, never mind. And I went and did something else. So he didn't quite hit the nail on the head there, but I feel like he was really close.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'm just too stupid to play his games.
Or he's appealing to a different kind of challenge. He does have a lot of engineering in his games, and we both do engineering as our day job. So it could be like, oh, this looks like a lot of work, because it's very similar to what we do for work.
Yeah, could be.
All right, we're going to hit lens 52, the lens of the puzzle, and then we'll be done with this chapter. Puzzles make the player stop and think. To ensure your puzzles are doing everything you want to shape the player experience, ask yourself these questions. What are the puzzles in my game? Should I have more puzzles or less, and why? Which of the 10 puzzle principles apply to each of my puzzles? And do I have any incongruous puzzles, and how can I better integrate them into the game?
I'm just going to point out that his editor is failing to correct his less to fewer there, because puzzles is a countable noun, so he should be using fewer.
There we go. Puzzles. Boom.
Grammar is a puzzle, and you can succeed at it.